Romans chapter 3, the first four verses. Then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way, to begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. May God add blessing to the reading of his word.
In Romans chapter 3, the Apostle Paul pulled the rug out from under the Jews. They thought they had it made with God. Several reasons why. First, they were Jews, for pity's sake. I mean, they were God's chosen people. And if God's chosen people weren't right with God, who could be right with God? And then they had the law, and that's something nobody else had. They had the law of Moses. And then, and this was their coup de grace, they had circumcision. And they believed that if they were circumcised, then they were absolutely right with God. In fact, their rabbis taught them that no man who was circumcised would ever see hell. They thought they had it made. And then the Apostle Paul came along, and he pulled the rug out from under them. Yes, they had the law, but if they did not follow the law and obey the law, then why were they any better than the Gentiles who did not have the law? Doesn't do much good to possess the law if you don't practice the law. And since they did not practice the law and obey what it said, their circumcision was meaningless. Paul essentially says that if you break the law, your circumcision is made uncircumcision. Now, he knew that would not sit well with the Jews who were hearing this read at the church in Rome. So in chapter 3, he anticipates their questions and answers them before they have a chance to ask them. The opening verses of chapter 3 are what many people have described as a diatribe. A diatribe is a written or verbal technique where you pretend like you're in a conversation with someone. That someone's asking questions, you're answering those questions, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. And that's a pretty good description of what we have in the first several verses of Romans chapter 3. It reminds me of my high school days when I used to compete in these thespian deals. Any of you thespians? You know, it was a lot of fun. I was never very good at it. But our school would take teams to different schools to compete with speeches or short dramas or monologues you would do from the front of the room. Once I tried my hand at the one-person monologue, I memorized a piece of James Thurber's book, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and tried to kind of act it out in front of the room. And the way that works is when you're one character, you're kind of, you know, you're tall, you're looking down at this person, and you're saying what you want to say. And then you turn and you look up at this person, you're talking to them. Like I say, I was never very good at it, but it was a lot of fun. A diatribe is something like that. You can picture the Apostle Paul playing two roles, the questioner and the answerer. He's posing questions as if he were one of the Jews. He's turning and then answering those questions as if he were the Apostle Paul. Some think that Paul was, in fact, reconstructing conversations that he had had with Jews over the years. Remember, Paul was a church-planting missionary. He traveled all over the Mediterranean world planting churches. By this time, he's been in ministry 25 to 30 years. And you remember his method when he went into a city. The first place he would go was to the synagogue, because he would take the gospel to the Jew first and then to the Gentiles. He had lots of experience talking about the gospel with Jews. In fact, the second chapter of Romans might well have been a well-worn sermon that he preached many times in the Jewish synagogues. He knew exactly what they would say, because he'd heard him say it many times before. So, chapter 3 may just be a reconstruction of one of those conversations that he'd had with Jews during those years of ministry. On the other hand, some think that Paul's passage in Romans 3 is a soliloquy between Saul of Tarsus, the guy he was before he got saved, and Paul the Apostle, the guy he was after he got saved. One writer described this as Paul the unconverted Pharisee, expressing attitudes that Paul the Apostle well remembered from his days being a Pharisee. So maybe he's really just debating himself. He plays the role of what I was before I got saved and what I am now that I am saved. And something about that appeals to my imagination. don't know why, and I don't know that it matters. Fact is, I don't really know what was in Paul's mind, except he's posing questions and he's giving answers. The primary question he is addressing is, what advantage then hath the Jew? If their relationship with Abraham, and if their possession of the law, and if their practice of circumcision doesn't save them, then what good is it? That's a great question, isn't it? This morning I'm going to show you three things from the text. First, we're going to see a surprising answer. Second, we'll see a reassuring reminder. And third, we're going to see an eternal truth. Let's talk about that surprising answer real quickly. If we had not read this text out loud and it was not fresh in your minds, and if you're not familiar with Romans chapter 3, I wonder what you would expect Paul's answer to the question to be. Let me reset the stage. The Jews think they have it made. They're God's chosen people. They have the law. They circumcise themselves. We've got it made. God will save us. And then Paul comes along and says, all of that is meaningless. You're a sinner just like the Gentiles. And so your question as a Jew is, okay, then what advantage hath the Jew? What profit is there in circumcision? What would you expect Paul's answer to be? Well, it's hard for me to play that role because I'm so familiar with the book of Romans, but I think my expectation would be Paul would say, you're absolutely right. There is no advantage. Sorry, guys, you blew it. I mean, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? This means yes, this means no. Okay, we're all together here. So we have a surprising answer. The question is, what advantage hath the Jew? What profit is there of circumcision? And notice Paul's response. Much in every way. Huh? I'm not saved by it. What advantage does it have for me? The law is burdensome. It doesn't save me. What's the advantage? Oh, much in every way. See, that's a surprising answer. That's not what I would have expected Paul to say. Now he's going to do something that drives a lot of people crazy. If you have a newer translation, following that phrase much in every way, you're going to see something like first or first of all. It sounds like Paul's about to start enumerating. And anytime somebody from the front of the room starts enumerating, after they're done with point one, what do you expect will follow? Well, there's going to be a point two. Look really closely. Can you find a point two in Paul's response? See, I'm in the seminar business, and it drives me crazy when trainers do that. If you're going to start numbering things, you got to at least have a point two, or don't give me a point one. So I guess if Paul were in my seminar room, I might have something to say to him about that. And I'm laughing at myself. I wouldn't say that to Paul. I'll say it to trainers, but I wouldn't say that to Paul. I'm sorry? That's true. I probably wouldn't be critiquing Paul. Well, in his defense, maybe he just picked it up later in the book. I mean, much later in the book. Here's the flow. What advantage hath the Jew? Much in every way, chiefly because unto them were committed the oracles of God. And then if you fast forward to chapter 9, he goes on and gives some other benefits they have. They have the adoption and the glory and the giving of the law and the covenants and the service of God and the promises. So he goes on later in the book and gives a lot of advantages that the Jews have. But that is so far removed, it's kind of hard to see the connection there. But those who want to defend Paul, that's, well, look, he finishes the list over here. Okay. Maybe the answer to the question, why did he start a list when he didn't mean to finish it, is he really didn't mean to start a list. See that word translated first or first of all? This is a case where I think the King James maybe has the better translation. Because the word translated first means first in time, place, order, or importance. And if you have a King James translation, it doesn't use one of those numbers. It just says chiefly. Chiefly. And that's a good translation of what Paul's saying. The primary advantage they have. What advantage hath the Jew? Oh, they have lots of advantages. The biggest advantage is, see, that's really the thrust of what Paul is saying, so I guess I wouldn't have anything to say to Paul in the seminar room, would I? Because I think he said exactly what he meant to say. This is the primary advantage they have. They have the oracles of God. Now that's an interesting word, oracles. It's only used four times in the New Testament. Whatever it's worth, it's always in the plural. It's never an oracle. It's always the oracles. I don't think that's significant. I think it's interesting. It's a Greek word. Have you ever heard of the oracles of Delphi? Does that ring a bell to anybody? Well, the Greeks, if they had a question for the gods, they'd go to Delphi. They would ask their question. I don't know exactly how it came out, but their god would answer with a short divine saying, and that became the oracles. It was a brief divine saying. Paul says the Jews have these divine sayings from God. What is their advantage? Their advantage is God has entrusted his word to them. You say, okay, so what? Well, compare that with the revelation that Gentiles had. What did the Gentiles know about God? Well, they could look at creation and they could infer there must be a creator. And you can infer a lot of things about God, his power and his brilliance and his order. Lots of things you can get from creation. The Jews, though, have that as well as the written word of God, which specifically tells them what God is like, which specifically tells them how they can be right with God and what God's expectations of them were. They have a great advantage over the Gentiles because they have God's specific revelation. One writer said that by their possession of the law, the Jews had an advantage over the heathen, much as the educated man has a better chance in life than the one who's never been to school. And I think that's a pretty good illustration. See, a person can be successful and do well if they never go to school. And a Gentile who doesn't have the law, they can come to know God. But the one who's been at school, by and large, typically has more job opportunities than the one who has not. And the one who has God's law, well, they have a way of knowing God that those who don't have the law don't have. So you can see that's a pretty big advantage. What advantage hath the Jew? Oh my goodness, they have the oracles of God. There may be something else in this text. This comes from a lexicon. And I was just remembering when I bought this lexicon. A lexicon is a Greek dictionary. Takes Greek words, does the English meanings. My second year at Moody Bible Institute was when I had my first Greek class. And they, if you've been to college, you know the first week you have to go buy all these books. And it's always sticker shock. I mean, these books are just obscenely expensive. And the professor, Dr. Hake, said, for our class, you need to get the, I even have to look at the title, the Greek-English Lexicon of the New Testament. Edited by two guys, Arndt and Gingrich, and so we just called it Arndt and Gingrich. And it was obscenely expensive. I forget what it cost then. I just remember all of the Greek students, I mean, we're poor students, college students. How can we afford this? I looked it up the other day. It's now selling for $125. And I don't know what it was then, but that sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? And I'll never forget the first week after we'd had an assignment, go translate this text or define these words. Cal Haynes, a fellow student, raises his hand in class, and he says, Dr. Hake, how are we supposed to make heads or tails of this lexicon? I can't understand a word of it. And you know what? I couldn't either. You know, you expect to open the dictionary and find meaningful definitions, and instead, this has all these citations from this papyrus and this fragment and this thing and that thing. And you get maybe a two or three word definition and you sit there scratching your head, what good is that? Well, anyway, today I'm glad that was on my shelf. Saved me $125 because I've already got it. But I really like their definition of the word oracles. Here's what they say. It speaks of God's promises to the Jews. God's promises to the Jews. What advantage hath the Jew? Oh, much in every way. They have God's promises. God has promised a lot of things to the Jews, much of which has not yet occurred. God promised them, for instance, there would be a kingdom where the Son of David would rule and reign over an extended period of peace and prosperity. Now, some people think that was fulfilled in Solomon, but it was not fulfilled in Solomon, because I was just reading in Isaiah the other day. I'm in Isaiah in my Bible reading now. And he was talking about how the Son of David will sit on David's throne. By the way, if you're not familiar with the chronology, that was a long time after Solomon. Solomon was long dead and gone. Isaiah is still looking for that promise to occur, that the Son of David would sit on the throne. He promised, or the scripture, the oracles promised, the nations would come to Jerusalem to learn about God. God promised that the Jews would be a blessing to the entire world. Maybe in Romans chapter 3, Paul is thinking about what God will yet do for the Jews. What advantage hath the Jew? You gotta be kidding me. Much in every way, chiefly, they have God's promises, and God isn't done with them yet. Now, I'm reading between the lines just a little bit with that. But it certainly lends itself to that interpretation. Paul may be looking at the promises, the blessings that the Jews have not yet realized. He'll elaborate on that when we get to Romans 9, 10, and 11. He will tell us that God is not yet done with the Jews, that God will pick up and bless the Jews. And maybe this is just a glimmer of that in chapter 3 and verse 2. They've got the oracle. The problem with the Jews was not that the possession of the law and the practice of circumcision were meaningless. The problem is they had made it meaningless because they refused in their hearts to walk with God and to really know Him. The law showed them how to know God. The circumcision was a reminder of their relationship with God, but they did not give those things the meaning that God intended. Those things became meaningless. So, what did advantage does a Jew have? Oh, well, here's the surprising answer. Much in every way. They've got the oracles of God. That's the surprising answer. Let's look at the second thing, a reassuring reminder. This is verse 3. He says, what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. Now, that must be a difficult phrase to translate from Greek to English, because I've read all kinds of translations. Let me just read several to you. But Paul, what of the fact that some Jews have not proven faithful? What of it? Their unfaithfulness cannot cancel God's faithfulness, can it? That's one way to translate it. Or this. What, you might ask, of the fact that some Jews have not proven faithful? This does not mean, does it, that God will be any less faithful on his part? That's another way to translate it. Here's another way you could translate it. For what then? Though some of them were unfaithful, their unfaithfulness will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? I don't know which of those is the better translation, but they all have this in common. It's looking at the unfaithfulness of the Jew and saying, will that somehow undermine the faithfulness of God? They have not faithfully kept his law. Will he then not be faithful to them? Notice Paul's response. God forbid. Now, that's not the way I typically talk. I just almost feel like I'm being sacrilegious when I talk that way. That's not an expression I typically use, but Paul's making a point here. That phrase is Paul's most emphatic repudiation of something he thinks is wrong. It's been variously translated with phrases like not at all, or never, or by no means. Put it out of your mind. Don't even think about it. Their unfaithfulness will not alter the faithfulness of God. Whatever the Jews do, God will be faithful to his promises. Now, I've told you last week in this that Romans 9, 10, and 11 can pick up with God's intentions for the Jew. Let me just give you a glimmer of some of that. Turn to Romans chapter 11. Romans chapter 11. I'm just going to read, four verses or so, five verses. Starting verse 25. Paul says, I would not, brethren, you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own conceits. that blindness in part has happened unto Israel until, and see, they've been blinded. They're not embracing the truth. But it's temporary. It's come on them until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And notice this next phrase. And so all Israel shall be, that's futurism, shall be saved. What that tells you is God is not done with Israel. If you think God just wrote them off and that the church is now Israel, you're not reading the same Bible that I'm reading. I mean, that's just pretty clear. God is not done with the Jews. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I shall take away their sins. Now understand, this is New Testament, okay? This is after Christ has come. And Paul is still looking for a time when God will work in the nation of Israel and take away their sins. Then he says, it's concerning the gospel, they're enemies for your sakes, but it's touching the election. They're beloved for the Father's sake. Now notice this next phrase. The gifts and callings of God are without repentance. God doesn't change his mind. He promised he would do certain things for the Jews. He has not changed his mind. He will do it. Yes, the Jews have been unfaithful. Does that mean God will also be unfaithful? Put that out of your head. No way. See, that's the reassuring reminder. By the way, I'm not Jewish. As far as I know, nobody in this church is Jewish, but I've got that same promise. Paul wrote to his friend Timothy, he said, if we believe not, yet he abideth faithful. He cannot deny himself. I find great comfort in that because there are times when my faithfulness wavers. Am I the only one who's ever had that experience? He abides faithful. He cannot deny himself. What he has promised, he will do. See, I find strength and comfort in that because what it tells me is my salvation is not dependent upon me and my faithfulness. If it were, then I'm in trouble. It's not dependent upon me and my faithfulness. It's dependent upon God and his. Aren't you glad for that? I find great comfort and rest in that. That's a reassuring reminder. So we've seen a surprising answer. We've seen a reassuring reminder. Now let me show you an eternal truth. This first part of verse 4. God forbid, yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. Now notice he's repeating this contrast. In the previous verse, it was the Jews' unfaithfulness. In spite of that, God is still faithful. Now in verse 4, it's yeah, let every man be deceitful. Let every man be a liar. God is still true. So again, he's contrasting the deceitfulness of man with the truthfulness of God. Now when the Bible speaks of God being true, it usually means not that he's honest, though God is honest. But that's not the emphasis. The emphasis is on the fact that God is reliable. He's trustworthy. He's true to his word. He will do what he says he will do. The eternal truth is we can count on God to do exactly what he said he will do. Now, in this context, that's kind of a double-edged sword. Because remember this context, he's talking about the sinfulness of man and the coming judgment of God. When he says that God is true, the nice side of that sword is that God will save those whom he has promised to save. I mean, it cuts that way, and that's reassuring, isn't it? But the other side of that sword is that God will also, just as he will be faithful in saving those who believe, he will be faithful in judging those who do not. And that's not a way we typically think about God's faithfulness, is it? But that's really what Paul is pointing out here. God's faithfulness cuts both ways. Those who have rejected him, they will be judged, and that will be a demonstration of God's truthfulness, God's faithfulness. That's an interesting way to look at judgment, isn't it? There's an interesting illustration of this in the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. Let me give you the backstory for this. What happened is the nation of Israel fell away and from God, stopped serving him. He warned them time and again through his prophets. He said, you turn to me, you walk with me, or judgment is coming. Well, finally the day came. It was 586 B.C. God sent the Babylonians to conquer the city of Jerusalem. He destroyed the city. He killed many people. He deported thousands of Jews into Babylon. You know, as I was thinking about that, I was thinking about what we're seeing in Ukraine. How many have now been left homeless and they're refugees? They're running from home for their lives. I've heard numbers from 1 million to 2 million people. I mean, you just think about how heartbreaking and upsetting that is. That's what happened to the Jews because of their sin. God warned them. They ignored his warnings. They went on in their sin. And they were deported into a strange land, Babylon. Babylon, by the way, is in modern-day Iraq. I mean, I can think of a lot of places I'd rather be shipped than Iraq. How about you? It wasn't any more beautiful then than it is now. Of course, I've not been there. I just know what I see on television. So maybe it's a paradise for all I know. But for the Jews, it was a strange land. They were there for 70 years. God judged them. Many were killed. Others were made slaves. They were carried captive into Babylon. 70 years later, God allows them to return to the promised land. They go back in several waves. In the first wave, was led by Ezra. He was a priest. They rebuilt the temple. And then Nehemiah came a little later. He was a politician, really. And he came and rebuilt the walls. That's the backstory to the book of Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah chapter 9, Nehemiah prays a prayer. I want you to listen to this prayer. He says, so now our God, the great, powerful, and awesome God, who keeps covenant fidelity. You're the one who does what you say you will do. Do not regard as inconsequential all the hardship that has befallen us. See, Nehemiah is looking back on that destruction by the Babylonians, the judgment of God and their captivity in Babylon. Don't regard that as inconsequential. Our kings, our leaders, our priests, our prophets, our ancestors, all your people, from the days of the kings of Assyria till this very day. Now listen to this next phrase. This is key. You are righteous in regard to all that has happened to us, for you have acted faithfully. Think about all that had happened to them. They had been conquered by a foreign adversary. They had been kicked out of their homes. They were refugees in a strange land. Nehemiah says, you're righteous because in doing that, you have acted faithfully. And then he wraps it up like this. It is we who have been in the wrong. When you think about the faithfulness of God, don't just think of his faithfulness in blessing his people. He's also faithful in judging the unbelievers. Here's the eternal truth. You can always count on God to do exactly what he said he will do. He promised to save those who will believe on him, and he will. He promised judgment for those who do not believe on him. And he's just as faithful with that judgment as he is with that salvation. That's why it's incumbent upon us to share the gospel with others so they can know that side of God's faithfulness. We've seen a surprising answer. We've seen a reassuring reminder. We've seen an eternal truth. All three of those things are still relevant today. Like the Jews, we have the oracles of God. We've got the same book they had, plus 27 others. We got the New Testament. They didn't have that. They were not faithful to what God gave them. So what do you suppose is the challenge to us? Well, let's be faithful to what God has given us. He's given us his word. Let's learn it. Let's know it. Let's do it. let's not just pay lip service to it. Let it make an impact in our lives. We also have a reassuring reminder that God is faithful even when we are not. And it's possible I'm speaking to somebody who's struggling right now with your own unfaithfulness. Will God still love me? Will God still care? Yes, absolutely. He'll take you back. He'll restore you again. God is faithful. We have an eternal truth. We can always count on God. Can't count on men, can we? I guess I should not be sexist. Can't count on women either, can we? Can't count on politicians. But you can always count on God. That's a great truth, isn't it? Father, I thank you for these truths. Thank you that you, the eternal God, are faithful and true. I pray we find rest for our souls in knowing that. And Father, you know the hearts of each of us, where we are in our walk with you, and those who need to have that pressed and burned in their hearts. I pray you would burn it in, make it meaningful. May they know your faithfulness and your truth. May we be encouraged to live more faithfully for you. May we hold on to these truths. Maybe we make them known for others so that they too can know your faithfulness. Bless us.